subscribers in 2011. And to do that, let me tell you a story about NBA point guard Mike Conley. Chapter 2, ESPN and Mike Conley. When the 2016 NBA season began, four players in the history of pro basketball had made $30 million a year. Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, and Memphis Grizzlies point guard Mike Conley. That is, three of the 10 greatest players in the history of the game had made $30 million a year, and a solid, if not spectacular, 6'1", 175-pound point guard entering his ninth NBA season also made $30 million a year. Conley, who joined the NBA at the age of 19 after his freshman year at Ohio State, was drafted fourth overall, and during his professional career had averaged 13 points, 5.5 assists, and 2.8 rebounds a game. He had never made an NBA All-Star team in his nine seasons. That leaves us with a fascinating question. How did a relatively average player like Mike Conley end up signing a five-year, $154 million contract? A contract that paid him similarly to the top players to ever play the game. I'll tell you, he hit free agency at the perfect time, just as the NBA was flush with cash from a television contract paying the league $2.66 billion a year, $1.47 billion from ESPN, and $1.19 billion from Turner Sports. The TV contract, a staggering sum of money committed just as the cord-cutting era began to assault the cable and satellite industries, boggled the sports industry's minds. The NBA had received triple its prior television deal. Overnight, every player, even a guy like Mike Conley, was swimming in cash. Okay, you might be thinking, but surely ESPN and Turner Sports were paying a rational sum of money for the NBA television package, right? You'd be wrong. Before we explain why that's the case, let's first dive into the economics behind 21st century sports on television. ESPN is the most lucrative business in the history of media, valued at $50 billion as recently as 2014 by Forbes magazine. How did ESPN attain that level of valuation? Well, ESPN owes its money to a dual revenue stream business structure. It makes 75% of its money from cable and satellite subscriber fees and 25% of its money from advertising. It surprises many people to learn that their cable and satellite bills are a collection of bundled charges for individual channels. That is, while you may have 200 stations and not realize it because your bill isn't itemized, each cable or satellite channel is being paid a carriage fee by a cable or satellite company. Effectively, you are paying for every cable channel you receive in your bundled package, even if most viewers don't realize it. Now, most of these charges are relatively small. AMC costs viewers roughly a quarter a month, for instance. However, a handful of channels, those featuring sports, are quite expensive. ESPN is far more expensive than any other channel on cable. In fact, here are the 10 most expensive channels per month in cable packages, according to a summer of 2018 analysis from Kagan, a media research group within S&P Global Market Intelligence. Number 1, ESPN costs $8.14 a month. Number 2, TNT, cost $2.28 a month. The Disney Channel was in third place, tied with the NFL Network at $1.58 each. Fox News is in fifth place at $1.57. The USA Network cost $1.24. TBS cost $1.10 in seventh place. ESPN2's in eighth place at $1.02 a month. CNN is in ninth place at 86 cents a month, and the SEC Network is the 10th most expensive cable channel at 78 cents a month. Seven of these 10 networks feature sports, four of them full-time. The USA Network features the WWE. FS1 and the Big Ten Network are the 13th and 15th most expensive cable channels as well, both of which feature sports full-time. Do the math here and you learn an interesting fact. Every year, ESPN receives nearly $100 from every single cable and satellite subscriber in the country. That's whether you watch the channel or not. So you, who are presently reading this book and probably a sports fan, are paying nearly $100 a year for ESPN, and so, interestingly, are your Aunt Gladys and your Uncle Hugh, neither of whom have watched sports all year. That's where 75% of ESPN's revenue comes from. Effectively, ESPN receives close to the same amount of subscription money as Netflix and HBO each month, only, unlike with Netflix or HBO, most cable and satellite subscribers have no idea what they pay for ESPN, and significantly, no one is electing to sign up and pay ESPN this amount of money. Add on advertiser revenue, and ESPN also pockets another several billion a year. What does ESPN do with all this money? It buys sports rights, which in turn, it hopes, ensures that people will keep watching ESPN, and as a result that their carriage fees will remain through the roof and advertisers will keep ponying up cash. Hence, the NBA deal. As part of the NBA's collective bargaining agreement, players and owners split revenue, and that windfall of TV money was then redistributed to the players. That's how Mike Conley becomes a $30 million man, just like Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, and LeBron James before him. So everything's great. Money's pouring in from two sources, and it seems that this sports gravy train should continue for years ahead, right? However, as noted ESPN mascot head wearer Lee Corso would say, not so fast, my friend. ESPN makes its money by renting the content that others produce, sports games, and distributing them to the masses. This makes ESPN the sports equivalent of Blockbuster Video. And just like Blockbuster Video, it is slated for economic collapse and obsolescence, which I'll explain later in the book. For now, all you need to know is that Mike Conley's contract wasn't supported by any legitimate economic reality. It was the product of a sports bubble, one fueled by ESPN's broken business model. Of course, ESPN, the NBA, and others may argue that Conley's contract, as a result of the NBA's huge new television deal, is simply a function of market realities. That ignores the fact that sometimes markets break and for a time can behave irrationally. We saw it with NASDAQ stocks during the tech stock boom in the early 2000s and in the recent subprime housing collapse that nearly torpedoed the entire global economy. We saw it with tulips in Holland in the 17th century. Really, read up on this if you haven't before. And we'll see it again and again throughout human history. If anything, social media may make bubbles more likely today than in past years. After all, bubbles are the product of frenzy, excitement, and the masses losing their heads. If that doesn't perfectly describe our present era on social media, what does? Indeed, the story of Mike Conley's contract in many ways epitomizes the sports industry's own bubble. In Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, about the collapse of the subprime mortgage industry and the near collapse of the American economy, the principals in that book, who are soon to make billions betting against the American housing market, experience a sudden realization at a strip club in Florida when a stripper confesses to having five houses and a condo. Don't worry, she tells the investors. She's only paying interest. When I saw Conley's contract and realized it made him among the four highest paid players in the history of the NBA, it set off the same kind of alarm bells for me as the stripper had for the investors in Lewis's book. I had to examine the underlying economics of his salary to understand how Conley's salary could possibly be justified. What I found was staggering. ESPN was a bubble poised to burst. There was no rational way to justify what ESPN was paying the NBA. None at all. Remember, it's not ESPN paying the NBA for its games, it's us, the cable and satellite subscribers. ESPN and TNT are just taking our money and passing it along to the NBA. Moreover, the vast majority of cable and satellite subscribers are paying for the NBA, but they'll never watch a single NBA game. The data is staggering when you unpack the economic realities underpinning this deal. To pay for the new NBA rights deal, every single cable and satellite subscriber, and there are about 86 million of us with ESPN in 2018, chips in roughly $3.10 a month or $37.20 a year. Since the NBA only plays 8 months a year, you're actually paying $4.65 a month for the 8-month season. Remember, the NBA finals are on free TV. To reach this number, I'm simply dividing the NBA's new TV contract by the number of cable and satellite subscribers. Given that every single cable and satellite subscriber is paying $37.20 a year for the NBA, How many people watch the most popular of these games? The Western Conference Finals on TNT in 2016 were a scintillating seven-game series that saw the Golden State Warriors surge back from a 3-1 series deficit to beat the Oklahoma City Thunder. It was the highest-rated playoff series in TNT history, and an average of 9.9 million people watched each game. The 2018 Western Conference Finals also went seven games and featured the Golden State Warriors triumphing over the Houston Rockets. That series averaged just over 10 million viewers a game, which sounds like a lot. But another way of looking at that would be by saying 76 million cable and satellite households didn't watch the series. That is, nearly 90% of cable and satellite subscribers with TNT didn't care to watch two of the best Western Conference Finals in NBA history. That's pretty common. Sports fans are a vocal and lucrative minority of the overall American population. And that's the Western Conference Finals, which produced a good product. ESPN broadcast the much less exciting Eastern Conference Finals in 2016, and the ratings were dismal. An average of just 5.5 million people tuned in for the Cleveland Cavaliers closing out of the Toronto Raptors. That means 79 million households, or 92% of all cable households, didn't watch the highest-rated NBA series on ESPN that year. The NBA Finals are on ABC, which everyone gets for free. The NBA Finals ratings in 2016 were outstanding, but again, it's on broadcast television, which doesn't require a cable or satellite subscription to watch. The 2018 Eastern Conference Finals between the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Boston Celtics also went seven games, but only 9 million viewers a game tuned in for this series. Even with the best possible matchup going the maximum number of games, not that many people watched. Putting those NBA viewership numbers into context, more people watched the NFL Draft and the Pro Bowl than watched an average NBA Eastern or Western Conference Finals game on TNT or ESPN. The cable bundle's a great deal for us sports fans because the 90% of people who don't watch the Eastern or Western Conference Finals are subsidizing the cost of our sports on cable. I love watching the NBA. I'm happy I only have to pay $37.20 a year to do it. Would I be so happy to be paying that $37.20 a year for the NBA if I was like the vast majority of Americans and never watched the league? I doubt it. This means nearly all of Mike Conley's salary is being paid by people who will never watch him play basketball. It also means ESPN has created the biggest bubble in the history of media. If only those of us who watched had to pay for these games, we'd be paying roughly $400 a year. What does economics teach us again and again about bubbles? Eventually, they pop. And ESPN's bubble has popped, only most haven't realized it yet. ESPN executives have, however, seen the math, and they know the reckoning is coming, that the bubble has popped. What do I mean by seeing the math? Let me explain. In 2012, something alarming began to happen at ESPN. After 32 years of steadily increasing subscriber numbers, ESPN began to lose subscribers. At first, the decline was small, barely noticeable. After all, a bit of fluctuation was perfectly normal, right? 2012 was also an important year for ESPN because challenges loomed on the horizon for the network. After years of owning the cable business by themselves, Fox, NBC, and CBS were finally going to get into the cable sports business too. Over the next several years, all three media companies would launch their own cable sports challengers for ESPN. What did ESPN do to combat these challengers? It doubled down on sports rights, arguing that the best possible way to protect its advantage on cable was to ensure it had the rights to the best possible games. As a result, rights fees for sports on television skyrocketed, and soon ESPN had constructed a powerful moat surrounding its cable business castle. Those yearly rights fees added up in a hurry over the next several years. $2 billion to the NFL for Monday Night Football and one playoff game. $1.47 billion for the NBA. $700 million to Major League Baseball. $608 million for the college football playoff. $225 million to the ACC, $190 million to the Big Ten, $120 million a year to the Big 12, $125 million a year to the Pac-12, and hundreds of millions more to the SEC. Consider this. It wasn't just the NBA that ESPN had overpaid for. The network's NFL Monday Night Football package and a single wild card playoff game cost ESPN $2 billion a year. $2 billion a year! That means ESPN was paying over $100 million per Monday Night Football game by 2017. That also means the average cable and satellite consumer was paying $23.26 a year just for Monday Night Football on ESPN in 2017. 85% of cable and satellite subscribers never watched the weekly Monday Night Football game either. Sound familiar? It's happening to every sports property ESPN owns. What's worse than overpaying? Overpaying and not being able to afford to overpay again. By the late fall of 2017, ESPN was signaling to Wall Street that it was unlikely to be able to afford the NFL when its deal expired in 2021. Yet the worldwide leader in sports could no longer afford the most popular sport in the country. By 2017, ESPN was in serious trouble, paying $7.3 billion a year in rights fees, more than any media company in America was paying for content. Even more alarming, unlike the other companies paying billions in rights fees like Netflix or Amazon, ESPN didn't own any of its content. It was just renting from the leagues. If the NFL ever took Monday Night Football back, unlike Netflix, which would own Stranger Things or House of Cards forever, ESPN would be left with nothing at all to show for the billions in dollars in costs it had turned over to the NFL. The NFL even retained the rights to ESPN's broadcast in future years to air on its own network. In an era when all that mattered was owning original content, ESPN produced nothing of any lasting value that it retained at all, save for the 30 for 30 documentary series. But with 100 million subscribers in 2011 and billions in sports fees, ESPN had made its bet, outspent the competition for the best sports rights, and nothing could go wrong, right? Wrong. Unfortunately for ESPN, the subscriber decline began to accelerate. And when the subscriber losses hit 5 million, alarm bells went off inside ESPN headquarters in Bristol. Why were so many ESPN subscribers disappearing? What did that mean for the future of the company? ESPN, which had looked so strong in 2011, suddenly started to look much weaker by 2016. Indeed, in a Wall Street Journal article in the spring of 2018, ESPN acknowledged it had gotten the impact of cord cutting completely wrong. Back in 2014, ESPN's research department argued that cord cutting was unlikely to become an issue for the company. The research department was horridly wrong. As a result, ESPN continued to wildly overpay for sports rights based on inaccurate business forecasts. Later, ESPN executives would have a name for those who had gotten things so wrong. They were flat earthers, said one former executive to the Wall Street Journal. Getting the massive decline in subscriber numbers was particularly troubling because the only asset ESPN had was its distribution ability. All the leagues knew that ESPN could reach their audience better than they could. But even that was changing rapidly. Leagues were realizing they could easily find their target audiences online on Facebook or Twitter. The highlight died. Conversations moved to Twitter. ESPN still owned all the sports rights, but it needed tonnage. It needed to fill all the time slots in the day that used to be dominated by SportsCenter, and it needed to make money off those shows too. With billions guaranteed for sports rights fees in the years ahead and a declining subscriber base, ESPN suddenly faced a scary reality. Its business model was under attack on two fronts. The cost of the sports it rented and put on the air was surging, just as its subscriber revenue was collapsing. ESPN's goal had been to create an impenetrable moat surrounding its castle. But now the moat was starting to flood the castle, just as the castle suddenly realized its powerful foundation was also built on quicksand. By the fall of 2017 and the spring of 2018, according to Nielsen cable and satellite channel estimates, ESPN was losing over 15,000 subscribers a day due to cord cutting, the death of older subscribers, and probably password sharing. Many subscribers were also turned off by the political nature of ESPN's programming and were abandoning it in droves as well. But we'll get to that in a moment. In 2011, at the height of its business, ESPN had 100 million subscribers. Since then, they've lost 14 million subscribers, an average of roughly 2 million lost subscribers a year, with the numbers increasing in recent years. In fact, if ESPN subscriber defections continued at the same rate as from 2011 to spring of 2018, the network, which finished 2017 with roughly 86 million subscribers, could begin losing money within 4 years. Here's what those subscriber numbers would look like if they continued at the present rate of decline. 2018 would finish with 83 million subscribers. 2019 would go to 80 million subscribers. In 2020, ESPN would fall to 77 million subscribers, and by 2021, ESPN would be left with only 74 million subscribers. Each of those lost subscribers represented somewhere in the neighborhood of $110 a year in lost revenue for the company. When ESPN lost a subscriber, remember, it typically lost a subscriber not just on ESPN, but also ESPN2, ESPNU, ESPN News, and ESPN Classic as well, that lost revenue was unlikely to return, and it added up over the years. ESPN was also unable to offer its own direct-to-consumer streaming option because of the cable and satellite carriage deals it had signed. Unlike, say, HBO, which could offer a direct-to-consumer option for cord cutters, ESPN was contractually prohibited from offering ESPN directly to consumers. ESPN Plus, a direct-to-consumer streaming option, launched in April 2018, but it only featured the programming not good enough to put on television. In other words, you couldn't subscribe to ESPN directly and get the cable network programming without a cable or satellite subscription. Let's pretend you're an ESPN executive. You see your subscriber numbers plummeting. ESPN was losing over 15,000 subscribers a day by the fall of 2017 and over 16,000 a day in April of 2018. At the same time, your costs for that programming are skyrocketing. What do you do? Especially when those lost subscribers are costing ESPN $1.83 million a day in future subscriber revenue as of April of 2018. Add up all those 16,000 plus lost subscribers in April alone, and ESPN lost $55 million in future revenue in 1 month in the spring of 2018. That's a two-fronted war that's slowly encircling your business. You better find a new way to win that war. Except your ratings are also plummeting for your original programming as well. This means you're faced with an intractable problem. Your business is dying, and the entire purpose of your business for decades, sports highlights, are now available everywhere. Just as MTV lost relevance when YouTube became the de facto host for music videos, social media now distributes every sports highlight instantaneously. Whereas in the past, someone like me who grew up watching ESPN would put on SportsCenter in the morning before school to find out who actually won a game and see the highlights of that contest, now social media savvy fans are receiving the highlights sent directly to their phones the moment they happen. They don't even need to seek them out. The highlights are coming straight to their devices as notifications. And the youngest generation of all, my kids, as I mentioned earlier, wake up in the morning and ask Alexa who won the games. Seriously, Alexa, what do you do if the entire premise of why your business exists, to serve sports fans highlights and breaking news, suddenly disappears? You desperately seek relevance in the modern social media age. What does that relevance look like today? It's sports opinions, or the hot take culture. Making people care about your sports opinions could increase ratings and help to save your business if, as seems likely, eventually the teams and sports leagues will have direct relationships with the sports fan rather than use ESPN as a middleman. Remember, at the end of the day, ESPN is renting the games. With the highlights now prevalent everywhere online, the only thing they own that rates at all on a daily basis is their sports opinion shows. That's where they can make up the money they are losing elsewhere. However, you face another problem. Sports opinions don't move the needle on social media either, because social media is filled with sports opinions. It's incredibly hard to have an original sports opinion in 2018 on social media that makes people take note. After all, how many times can you debate Michael Jordan versus LeBron James? The answer is every day if you're Skip Bayless, who has now debated Michael Jordan versus LeBron James, always finding James lacking for 14,643 consecutive days. Okay, what about breaking news, you might think? Another brick wall. The news cycle moves so rapidly that the minute sports news breaks, it's everywhere. Most fans don't even realize who broke the news. If sports news has limited value, and sports opinions about that sports news are also commodified in a world awash in sports opinions, what do you have left to move the ratings needle and try to save your business? You have sports opinions mixed with politics. And that's what ESPN aggressively moved into as its business collapsed. Sports opinions mixed with politics would be their savior, their raison d'etre. Sports opinions mixed with politics seem sexy because it plays well on social media. Unfortunately for ESPN, it's ultimately self-defeating because you may win a daily battle, but you're losing the overall war. You're alienating a large percentage of your audience that just wants sports. Hell, most of us come to sports to escape the political obsession currently infecting every aspect of American life. Faced with a business crisis, ESPN looked to Twitter and Facebook to save it and saw that sports mixed with politics was an untapped terrain that could offer ratings promise. Whereas in years past, sports networks had treated athlete political opinions like Hollywood treats actor and actress opinions as distractions unworthy of serious contemplation, ESPN suddenly decided to treat every athlete as if they were Muhammad Ali opposing the Vietnam War. Wedding sports and politics was ESPN's desperate sporting gambit, a Hail Mary designed to increase ratings and save a collapsing business. Best of all, it offered something ESPN didn't have, relevance. ESPN decided that combining sports and politics would make it matter in the modern era, but ESPN also realized something else. Wedding sports and politics from a conservative perspective might alienate the advertisers it relied upon. This is where the Rush Limbaugh example comes in. No advertiser has ever pulled out of a sports show because the show was too liberal. Only if that show was too conservative. The network made the decision not just to embrace sports and politics, they decided to marry sports to left-wing politics. A big part of this decision came via John Skipper, the president who followed George Bodenheimer. Skipper was a far left-wing liberal, and his values immediately rolled throughout the company. He promoted talent who advocated far left-wing political positions and obsessively valued diversity over ratings. In fact, and this is a remarkable detail, before he, quote, resigned for substance abuse issues over an extortion claim relating to his use of cocaine, Skipper replaced ratings bonuses for ESPN management with diversity bonuses instead. ESPN management was now rewarded not by serving viewers, but by ensuring diversity was promoted over rating success. This is, put plainly, a horrible way to run a business, but the tone had been set. Even if you weren't a far-left liberal, you learned that the best way to keep your job was to embrace far-left-wing politics. Voila! In the space of a few years' time, ESPN tossed aside decades of apolitical coverage and became MSESPN, the progressive voice in sports and politics, lean forward and catch a football. Initially, it worked. Mentions of ESPN surged on social media as the network embraced the social justice warriordom of Michael Sam, Caitlyn Jenner, and Colin Kaepernick. Executives added more steam to the MSESPN connection, even, and this is flat out amazing, allowing SportsCenter's presenting sponsorship on many nights to be sold to MSNBC. As all of this happened, my sports audience began to revolt. I'd open Twitter and my readers and listeners and viewers would have attached a new segment, a new clip, one left-wing political absurdity after another continued to pile up until a full-scale fan rebellion began. Why, my fans asked, does ESPN feel the need to lecture me about progressive politics when I just want to watch sports. So much for just being able to come home, pop open a beer, and escape the country's problems. Now, instead of coming home from work and finding out the latest news on the NFC West and seeing a breakdown of the latest league highlights, which many fans still wanted, you got a panel debate on how heroic Colin Kaepernick was for taking a knee during the national anthem. Facing the collapse of its subscription business and with sports rights fees still surging at the exact moment that sports highlights, the core reason for ESPN's peripheral programming surrounding the games, became available for free everywhere, ESPN panicked and went fully political and turned sports into politics by any other name. Out were sports highlights, in was constant coverage of athletes' political opinions, and a perpetual sports culture war. It wasn't just praising the athletes either. It was elevating the talent that most fervently connected left-wing politics and sports. Jemele Hill, Max Kellerman, Sarah Spain, Bomani Jones, Michelle Beadle, Pablo Torre, the more left-wing your politics, the more you got on television. Every single one of these ESPN employees received their own television show. And as a result, lines between reporting and opinion vanished. Everyone at ESPN rushed to become as far left-wing as possible to serve the new clear business imperative. Give me MSESPN, and I'll give you contract extensions, raises, and TV shows. This sudden far left-wing liberal lean received rave reviews in the sports media, which was insanely left-wing itself, much more so than even the regularly attacked left-wing media and politics and news. In 2017, The Big Lead, a popular sports website, surveyed media members to find out how they'd voted in the 2016 election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. While the nation was nearly evenly divided, the sports media was not. According to an anonymous survey of prominent sports media members on that site, 80.4% voted for Hillary Clinton. 9.8% didn't vote. 5.9% voted for a third party. And just 3.9% voted for Donald Trump. That means 96.1% of the sports media didn't vote for Donald Trump. That's staggering when you consider that Trump received nearly half of the overall vote in the country and won 30 states in the Electoral College. It wasn't just that the sports media didn't like Donald Trump. Only 6% of the respondents in this survey even identified as Republicans. Fully 94% of all sports media surveyed by The Big Lead weren't willing to even consider voting for a Republican. I probably don't need to remind you, but Donald Trump actually won the election, opening a huge chasm between who sports fans vote for, sports fans are even more likely to vote Republican than the American public in general, and who the media who report and talk about sports support. That left-wing solidarity among sports media members leads to one of the scariest things in modern American life, groupthink. The political groupthink was staggering. ESPN employees gave Hillary Clinton 270 times more money than they gave Donald Trump in the 2016 election. Hillary Clinton received financial support from 217 different employees. Donald Trump received financial support from two, totaling $102. Putting those numbers in context, the American news media, which is routinely decried for its liberal bias, gave 27 times the money to Hillary Clinton that it gave to Donald Trump. ESPN gave 270 times as much to Hillary Clinton as to Donald Trump. Based on these public donation figures, ESPN is 10 times as biased towards the left as the news media in general. Wow. According to a study by Deep Root Analytics, the sports audience noticed this leftward turn, with Republican voters abandoning ESPN en masse from 2015 to 2016. Indeed, it was the Republican voters leaving the network that contributed to a tremendous ratings decline in ESPN's original programming. Now, despite the numbers cited above, it's not that no one in sports media votes Republican either. It's that those who do are terrified to admit it publicly for fear of losing their jobs. Don't worry, guys and gals, I'm not going to out anyone working at ESPN who votes Republican. However, many of the most prominent sports people you see on TV have privately sought me out to say thanks for embracing a marketplace of ideas and talking about the far left-wing environment at ESPN and in sports media in general. Think about this for a moment. Hundreds of ESPN employees publicly supported Hillary Clinton and lamented her loss in election night social media posts. Many of them, including top ESPN executives on the business side, sent tweets suggesting the world was coming to an end. Indeed, the number two man at ESPN right now, Connor Schell, publicly retweeted that Donald Trump was elected because, quote, Trump supporters openly voted for the oppression of LGBTs, minorities, and women's rights. In subsequent tweets, Schell said the president should be taunted over losing the popular vote, encouraged people to share pictures from the Women's March and compare them with the inauguration crowd to ridicule the president, tweeted encouragement to everyone to get involved in politics to combat Trump, and praised San Antonio Spurs coach Greg Popovich for attacking Trump. Now, certainly Schell is entitled to his own political opinions, but if you were working at ESPN and were a Republican or a Trump supporter, how comfortable would you be sharing those opinions if the man who decided whether you had a job or not was publicly on the record as hating Donald Trump? That's especially the case when your company was in the process of laying off hundreds of employees and when the directive from Disney CEO Bob Iger to then ESPN president John Skipper was favoring far left-wing politics. Iger made this point explicitly clear in a spring of 2018 Vogue magazine profile about his decision to run ESPN in a progressive left-wing manner. Why would he do this? Iger told Vogue he was preparing to run against Donald Trump as a Democratic candidate for president before a purchase of 21st Century Fox assets made that impossible. Do you really want to risk your job by coming out against the candidates favored by your bosses? As a result, not one single ESPN employee publicly celebrated Donald Trump's election or announced he or she had voted for him. Not one. ESPN's embrace of far left-wing politics had so chilled political discourse in sports media that even people making millions of dollars a year to appear on your televisions were afraid to admit they'd voted for Trump because they feared losing their jobs if they did so. Why did they have this fear? Because hundreds of employees were being laid off at ESPN in 2016 and 2017, and also because of what happened to Curt Schilling, a conservative former ESPN baseball analyst, in the spring of 2016. Before we get to the firing of Curt Schilling, let's first examine the question, when did ESPN's left-wing bias first reveal itself and alter the trajectory of the company's history? I believe it started with the first openly gay football player in the NFL, Michael Sam. Chapter 3, Dragging the Sports Media Left. On May 10th, 2014, ESPN televised the final day of the NFL draft. As part of their coverage, they placed a camera in the residence where Michael Sam, a defensive end from the University of Missouri, who had recently announced he was gay, waited to see whether or not he would become the first openly gay player drafted by an NFL team. For several weeks, ESPN had obsessively chronicled the story, and now, with live cameras following his every move, Sam stood talking on his cell phone in a salmon-colored shirt with his boyfriend alongside him. Watching live at home, I texted a friend. "Watch," I said. "This is totally staged. ESPN is going to show Michael Sam kissing his boyfriend when he's drafted." "You're probably right," my buddy texted back. It was plain as day. ESPN wanted the controversy. They wanted the shot. They wanted Michael Sam's homosexuality to be inescapable to all their viewers. On the television screen, ESPN played up the drama. There you see him on the phone, and there you see the raw emotion an ESPN announcer intoned from Radio City Music Hall in New York City. Sam leaned over, overcome with emotion, and his boyfriend cradled him, gripping his hand tightly. Upon hanging up the phone, Sam embraced his boyfriend, and as the cameras rolled, Sam kissed his boyfriend on the lips, just as I predicted he would. Almost immediately, I noticed something interesting on Twitter. Left-wing sports opinionists celebrated the kiss, and then they went looking for someone to say something inappropriate about ESPN televising the kiss. In other words, it wasn't just that sports media on social media embraced Sam. It was that they wanted to find someone who didn't embrace Sam so they could rain down their derision upon that person. An angry sports media mob was out circulating, and woe unto anyone who didn't celebrate Sam's moment. This had been the real point all along. Not the kiss, but covering the supposed backlash. It didn't take long for an athlete to send out a tweet that the left-wing sports media found unacceptable. Miami Dolphins defensive back Don Jones tweeted OMG and horrible. Two tweets that rapidly went viral. Jones didn't want to see two men kiss on the sports network he was watching. Many viewers felt the same way as Jones, but they weren't employed in the NFL and they weren't public figures. It didn't matter how many NFL players said the right thing. The sports media pounced on Jones, turning the two tweets into a major news story. This would become an all too common template. An event occurs. Most people respond one way to the event, but one or two people don't respond that way. Then those one or two people's responses, representing a tiny minority of the overall responses, become major news stories. Reprisal for Jones's non-work-related commentary on his personal Twitter account was swift. Jones was banned from Miami Dolphins team activities and suspended from playing football until he underwent sensitivity training. Almost immediately, he began issuing abject apologies. I want to apologize to Michael Sam for the inappropriate comments that I made last night on social media, Jones said in a statement. I take full responsibility for them, and I regret that these tweets took away from his draft moment. I remember last year when I was drafted in the 7th round and all of the emotions and happiness I felt when I received the call that gave me an opportunity to play for an NFL team, and I wish him all the best in his NFL career. Jones also apologized to the Dolphins and their fans. I sincerely apologize to Mr. Ross, my teammates, coaches, staff, and fans for these tweets. I am committed to represent the values of the Miami Dolphins organization and appreciate the opportunity I have been given to do so going forward. Not content with this apology, the Dolphins also issued an official statement from head coach Joe Philbin. We were disappointed to read Don's tweets during the NFL draft. They were inappropriate and unacceptable, and we regret the negative impact these comments had on such an important weekend for the NFL. We met with Don today about respect, discrimination, and judgment. These comments are not consistent with the values and standards of our program. Now, many of you reading this may agree with Jones's apology and the Dolphins' actions, but I'm interested in pointing out something more intriguing. Why is this a story at all? There are roughly 1,700 NFL players. Jones isn't remotely famous. In fact, I bet that most of you have never heard of him before. While you, as I do, may feel that gay people deserve the right to be married and in loving relationships like anyone else, was Jones's Twitter commentary really that egregious in the grand scheme of things? Is a relatively anonymous NFL player writing OMG and horrible when two gay people kiss on a sports broadcast worthy of a team suspension and national news stories everywhere? I'd feel differently if Sam had been drafted by the Dolphins and Sam was set to become Jones's teammate. That wasn't the case here. Indeed, Sam wasn't even drafted by the same conference or division, meaning the two players weren't even likely to compete against each other. This represented one of the first times I noticed a substantial trend. Sports media members using news stories to advance their own political beliefs. Increasingly, the sports media became hawkish in searching out appropriate and inappropriate personal beliefs on social media and then turning those reactions into stories. The trend became commonplace in sports media. Find someone who disagrees with something you believe politically and shame them for that belief by turning their opinion into a news story. Again, why is an otherwise anonymous Miami Dolphins player's reaction to Michael Sam on Twitter legitimate news? Furthermore, is it unacceptable for an NFL player to believe that homosexuality is a sin, or for an NFL player not to want to see two men kissing when he's watching a sports event on television? Based on the standard the Dolphins laid out, that seems to be the case. If so, think about how absurd this standard is. You can be convicted of felonies and go to prison for those felonies and remain eligible to play in the NFL. But if you tweet that you don't like seeing two men kiss on television, you can't play in the NFL? That's insanity. Why in the world do NFL teams and the sports media care what an individual player thinks about gay marriage or two men kissing on a sports broadcast? Simple. Because they've all bought into the idea that sports and politics are indistinguishable. Why couldn't the Dolphins have just released this statement? We disagree with the opinions expressed by one of our players on his private Twitter account in his private life, but we aren't in the business of punishing opinions we disagree with outside of work hours. That's what teams and leagues should do. In fact, I think it's what all employers should do. If you feel strongly as an owner about your player being on the wrong side of an issue you care deeply about, you can privately meet with him and suggest why he's wrong, but even that, in my opinion, is strange and unseemly behavior. Do you really want employers requiring employees to have the same political opinions as their bosses in order to keep their jobs? And do you want those same employers monitoring every comment on social media to ensure compliance as well? I don't. If you're listening to this book right now and you think that's perfectly appropriate, would you feel the same way if the ownership was insisting on conservative political beliefs? What if an owner believed abortion was murder? Wouldn't you think it was problematic if a player had to attend an abortion seminar designed to convince him his opinion that women should have the right to choose was wrong? What if you were Muslim, Jewish, or an atheist and you were forced to attend Christian church services with the owner until you agreed to adopt his religious belief? Again, when you've taken the red pill, you start to look around and ask yourself this question. Why does everyone have to have the same opinion on gay relationships in order to play football? Doesn't that begin to look a bit Orwellian? Even stranger, why are people with traditional beliefs the only ones who have to attend training to cleanse them of their prior opinions? I am far more troubled by our modern day fixation on acceptable and unacceptable opinions than I am by the opinions themselves. Because the NFL might well have considered approving of gay marriage to be an unacceptable opinion a generation ago. We'll return to Michael Sam in a moment, but this would rapidly become a prominent trend in sports. Forcing people you disagree with to apologize for their opinions, often after asserting the opinions at issue were racist, sexist, or insensitive, whatever that means. Sports Illustrated writer Andy Benoit saw it happen to him. He had the audacity to tweet that most women's sports weren't worth watching when an SI colleague tweeted a Women's World Cup goal and mocked him for not watching the event. That's an opinion that most American sports fans of both sexes share if you go by the ratings for what they watch. Most women's sports are much less popular than men's sports on television. In fact, the ratings are not even close, even in sports that are the same. Around 400,000 people watch a WNBA Finals game, compared to roughly 18 million who watch an NBA Finals game. Why are the numbers so different? Because male athletes are bigger, stronger, and faster playing their sports than women athletes are playing theirs. That's not sexism, it's biology. Unless, of course, you want to argue biology itself is sexist, which many left-wing sports writers would, no doubt, love to argue. Benoit's tweet went viral with left-wingers on social media. How dare a man not like women's sports as much as men's sports? Saturday Night Live even did a skit about it, ridiculing his opinion in the process. Benoit was forced to tuck his penis between his legs and apologize. He fell on the sword with this tweet. I got carried away responding to playful ribbing, and in my stupidity, overcompensated by saying something ignorant and extreme, 100% mistake on my part, for which I'm deeply sorry. Why do you have to be deeply sorry for not liking women's sports as much as men's sports? Or believe that opinion is, quote, ignorant and extreme? Choosing to watch men's sports instead of women's sports is literally what tens of millions of people, both men and women, do every single day. In 2015, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers announced a women's football clinic. Twitter was outraged and articles poured forth ridiculing the Bucs for doing what many teams had done before them. Then something curious happened. There was a clear disconnect between the social media faux rage and the real reaction at the Bucs ticket office. The event sold out immediately. Women love the opportunity to attend the clinic. It turns out much of the social media outrage was just fake public posturing and that social media didn't remotely reflect the real world, an idea we'll return to in later chapters. Yet this trend would continue again and again. An online left-wing sports media mob takes aim at someone's sports opinion for not being politically correct enough. Witness John McEnroe, who in 2017 wrote a book about tennis. and was so sexist he had the gall to say Serena Williams was the best women's player ever. Then this interview with a female NPR host went viral, and he was considered a sexist pig. NPR host. We're talking about male players, but there is, of course, wonderful female players. Let's talk about Serena Williams. You say she is the best female player in the world in the book. McEnroe. Best female player ever. No question. NPR host. Some wouldn't qualify it. Some would say she's the best player in the world. Why qualify it? McEnroe. You mean the best player in the world, period? Yeah, the best tennis player in the world. You know, why say female player? Well, because if she played in the men's circuit, she'd be like 700 in the world. You think so? Yeah. That doesn't mean I don't think Serena's an incredible player. I do. But the reality of what would happen would be, I think, something that perhaps it'd be a little higher, perhaps it'd be a little lower. And on a given day, Serena could beat some players. I believe she's so incredibly strong mentally that she could overcome some situations where players would choke because she's been in so many times, so many situations at Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, etc. But if she had to just play the circuit, the men's circuit, that would be an entirely different story. To his credit, McEnroe refused to back down amid the uproar. But I talked to several professional men's tennis players who said McEnroe had been far too kind. Serena wouldn't even be able to make most top college men's teams, much less beat professionals. She was nowhere near a top 700 men's player. The men tennis players are stronger, faster, and quicker than even the best women players. It would be no contest. Serena wouldn't even win a set against most top men's college players, much less the best professionals in the world. Yet John McEnroe was savaged for sharing his factual opinion about Serena's talents. She was the best women's tennis player ever, but nowhere near as good as a men's player. How about Kid Rock performing at the 2018 NHL All-Star Game? Surely no one could be upset by that decision, right? Wrong. The top story at ESPN.com was about the controversy surrounding Kid Rock's selection. The story offers a textbook example of left-wing sports writing about political issues disguised as legitimate sports news. First, let's start with the headline at ESPN.com. NHL aware of backlash over Kid Rock performing at All-Star Game, standing by decision. The headline itself tells us that nothing is changing. That is, the NHL is doing what the NHL was already doing, having Kid Rock perform at its All-Star Game. There is no substance to this story, and the headline tells us this before we read a word. Let's continue with the opening paragraph of that story. The National Hockey League said Thursday that it's aware of the backlash over Kid Rock performing at the 2018 All-Star Game in Tampa, saying that the decision to hire him was purely based on his entertainment value and history as a hockey fan. The opening paragraph here tells us that the NHL picked an entertainer to entertain because he's an entertainer. That seems like a logical NHL decision. However, the league is also, quote, aware of the backlash over their decision to pick Kid Rock. One of the real issues with social media today is that it only takes a couple of hundred people or even fewer on Twitter obsessively tweeting about something to constitute a backlash if the news media agrees with what those people are saying. The truth of the matter is there is no decision that a league, a team, a politician, or an entertainer can make in America today that doesn't immediately provoke backlash on social media. Another way to classify backlash would be to say that everyone on social media doesn't have the exact same opinion as a league, a team, a politician, or a famous person might have on every single subject. If you doubt me, go look at the reaction to every draft pick made by a team or every coaching hire. There are always people who disagree with the draft pick or the hire. That's because there has never been a time when opinions are more easily shared with the masses than the present day. But that isn't as powerful of a lead for a story because fans know this. Some fans disagree with the decision made in the NFL draft isn't a very powerful headline. Instead, there's a backlash on social media, which is just another word for disagreement, and this disagreement is used to justify the entire story's premise. Interestingly, the sports media would never base a backlash storyline on a string of sports talk radio callers because they would view that as an absurd and unrepresentative snapshot. So why use Twitter without a second thought? Especially since, unlike Twitter, we at least know a sports radio caller is a real person. What is the backlash here? Well, it's a few people on social media, many of whom are anonymous, stating they disagree with the decision to pick Kid Rock to perform at the NHL All-Star Game. Let's pause here for a moment and think about this. Can you imagine how little of a life you must have to be upset at the decision of which artist is going to perform at an All-Star Game? I mean, seriously, of all the things for a sports fan to be upset about, this is the hill you choose to die on? Which musical act is performing at the NHL All-Star Game? This is where your antenna should go up if you're an objective media member or a fan. Wait a minute, you should think. Do NHL fans really dislike Kid Rock this much? Or am I using an artificial basis for the premise of my article? Once an ESPN writer decides this is a story, the NHL is asked about the backlash. And the NHL can't say no comment when ESPN asks them about this made-up backlash. And they can't admit they haven't seen the fact that everyone doesn't agree with them, because that would make them look out of touch. So they say they're aware that everyone on Earth didn't agree with the Kid Rock decision, and that they didn't pick him for political reasons, but just because he's an entertainer who likes hockey. So that's what they said. Somehow, that's a lead story on ESPN.com. Let's continue with the second paragraph of the ESPN story. Remember, this is a story that editors have deemed to be a top story for the day in sports, what some people online think about Kid Rock performing at the NHL All-Star Game. The 47-year-old singer has drawn attention in the last year for endorsing President Donald Trump, his history of displaying Confederate flags at concerts, criticism of NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick's protest during the national anthem, and anti-transgender comments made during a concert. Wow. So conservative political opinions aren't allowed now for entertainers at sporting events? Because that's what this paragraph is designed to do, paint Kid Rock's politics as unacceptable to the masses, thereby disallowing a major sports league from being connected to him at all. Even though, and this is a key point, the majority of NHL fans vote Republican, disagree with Colin Kaepernick's protest during the national anthem, and probably don't think you're a hero if you change your gender. To be fair, NHL fans as a group probably don't have a strong opinion on the Confederate flag, since most of them are from the North, and the North won the Civil War, making the Confederate flag the equivalent of a participation trophy to them. Kid Rock's controversial political stances are supported by the league's fans. One thing I noticed once I took the red pill is that none of my left-leaning opinions are ever labeled as controversial. No one has ever written, "Travis, whose controversial belief that abortion and gay marriage should be legal and the death penalty should be impermissible." It's always my conservative opinions that are labeled as controversial. Now, it'd be one thing if all entertainers were subjected to the same backlash coverage, but that doesn't happen in the sports media. Only players, coaches, or artists with conservative political opinions provoke a backlash in the minds of the left-wing sports media covering a non-sports story like this. For instance, ESPN itself picked Kendrick Lamar to perform at halftime of the college football national title game between Georgia and Alabama. Kendrick Lamar's selection, like any decision on entertainment, certainly provoked a backlash on social media. Many college football fans aren't Kendrick Lamar fans and would have preferred another musical act instead, or to have the school bands perform. Interestingly, many of these fans may well have preferred Kid Rock. Unlike the average hockey fan who probably likes Kid Rock and supports his politics, college football fans in the South who voted for Donald Trump by an overwhelming margin certainly don't support Kendrick Lamar's far left-wing and liberal politics. Yet I didn't see MSESPN or any other sports website cover the backlash over Kendrick Lamar's selection. But if they had covered this backlash, do you know how that story would have run? They would have painted the fans who were upset about Lamar's selection as being racist because, as the mainstream media has taught us, anyone from Alabama and Georgia who disagrees with anything involving a black person is racist. The far left-wing sports media at ESPN could have very easily written the exact same opening paragraph about the college football playoff selection of Kendrick Lamar receiving a backlash and quoting the college football playoff leaders as saying Lamar was picked purely based on his entertainment value and status as a well-known football fan, and the decision had nothing to do with politics. The next paragraph of that Kendrick Lamar article could have just as easily said, the 30-year-old rapper has drawn attention in the last year for criticizing Donald Trump, his condemnation of the Confederate flag, his praise of quarterback Colin Kaepernick's protest during the national anthem, and his anti-police comments.